Hello and welcome to the Newism podcast, where we talk to social innovators and disruptors to discover how they would shape a new, more inclusive economic system fit for the modern world. Our guest this week is Bjørn Ihle, a Norwegian peace activist who survived the Utøya mass shooting in Norway in 2011. He now works to promote harmony and counter extremism and hatred through a variety of means, including writing, talks and filmmaking. He is a young leader in the Extremely Together movement, which mobilizes political will to overcome threats to peace, development, and human rights.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Newism podcast, where we're looking at what a future economy might look like. Really delighted to say that today on our podcast, we've got Bjørn Ihle from Norway, who's going to speak to us today about the values which might underpin a new economy. So welcome to the podcast, Bjørn.
Thank you.
You're in a Swedish forest today. Are you on holidays, or are you working, or having a chill time?
No, I live out here, so I'm sort of working, but also having a chill time at home for once. So I travel too much the rest of the year, so it's good to be back home for
great.
A couple weeks during summer.
Fabulous. So maybe you could tell us a little part of the introduction of what you're doing now, what the work that you're doing on a day-to-day basis.
So a lot of my work is about creating healthier communities, as I see it, communities in which people communicate better with each other, where people collaborate and work together rather than against each other. Where essentially the system is rigged in favor of people rather than against people. And that takes many different shapes. A lot of my work is about inclusion, about how we challenge stereotypes, about how we challenge hatred, and those things that seem to drive too much of humanity these days. But a lot of it also is about essentially making sure that people are capable of having conversations with each other in good ways.
So part of your work then is kind of putting people together who have possibly diametrically opposed views, and that's ending up in kind of hatred, believing potentially towards war, so that you can get a dialogue working to create solutions and which lead to peace.
No, I mean, let's look for solutions rather than for ways of hating each other is kind of usually the starting point. So yeah,
and it does seem in this day and age that the rhetoric globally is one of divisiveness and conflict, wars of words. So people are very quick to take a side and then blame another side or blame a group of people who they don't even know for all that's wrong. Is that your sense of what's going on just now?
I think that's one of many things that are going on right now. I think we see populism is happening, and that is essentially playing a lot of people's fears and ways and kind of using that as a tool to gain political and economical power. But at the same time, we also see that people are organizing in new ways and grassroots communities around the world, and that people are taking more power into their own hands and speaking up against those who try to oppress as well. And so many things are happening at the same time, and it's not necessarily all doom and gloom, but there is a bit of that as well, right?
I mean, the fact that groups of people are coming together, you know, because they want to create change. I might, for example, say, you know, people who are protesting and organizing about climate change. That isn't necessarily a bad thing, is it?
No, it's not. Like, people are coming together in kind of unprecedented ways. And we've seen things like right after the inauguration of Donald Trump in the US, we saw the Women's March, which was kind of a great step in the right direction, and that showed that people care and that people can gather and that people can work together to make things happen. We've seen the Black Lives Matter movement. We've seen after the school shooting in Parkland last year, we saw March for Our Lives. And that's just things that's been happening in the US that I've read about, but at the same time, there's things happening all over the world of people who are uniting and joining forces and standing up to oppressors. So I think like that's worth celebrating. And it's also worth seeing that that is to some extent a backlash against, forces that I think are bad, at least the forces of populism and the forces of those who are using hatred and violence to divide. I think the best show of defiance against those is the unity that's shown by those protests, essentially.
I mean, in some ways, these are populist movements, but they are forces for good, aren't they? And that's kind of what I wanted to kind of talk to you about is kind of these values. But what is the good in society that we're trying to create?
I mean, they are populist in some ways, but one of the things that I think is at the core of them is that they come from more of a distributed power system than rather than from one singular source. So like in conventional politics, largely we see populism as kind of singular. It's coming from like a populist political leader. It's coming from Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, Marine Le Pen, from Duterte, from Modi, from so many different singular leaders around. But at the same time, we have these popular movements, I would say, rather than populist movements, in that they are coming from the populace rather than being guided by someone who wants to guide the populace. And so I think that's a significant difference in how those movements evolve and how the values within those movements evolve as well.
That's interesting. So, and a key thing then all around seems to be people wanting change, that people aren't kind of satisfied in a sense coming from different positions on this. But you have in you know, Scandinavia, where you're from, actually societies that are stable, that people seem to be generally satisfied with the institutions. And, you know, is the Scandinavian model something that you think could be replicated globally, or is it just a kind of more peaceful part of the world, but it's still got fundamental issues?
So the Scandinavian model, I think, could be replicated. I don't necessarily think it's the best idea always. So we have some problems up here as well, where political leaders are doing strange and populist things. We have populist far-right parties in governments here as well. I mean, those things are creating divisions, and you could say that countries like Norway is more divided now than they've been before and are following the general trend of Europe. And so the model here as well is problematic and not necessarily something that should be replicated elsewhere, because I think we can come up with things that are better than this as well. And I think one of the things that I would say almost scares me about the Scandinavian model is that we have a tendency to think of it as a success. We have a tendency to think that it's good and does to some extent stop look for better solutions. But I think there's always room for improvement, and I think we should never stop looking for ways to improve. And I think that's really important if we want to progress. And so I think let's push further and let's look for something even better than the Scandinavian model as well, where we don't have those deep divisions and where we are able to truly collaborate and work in societies.
So how, I mean, the difficult question, I suppose, and what we're trying to get here into in the newism is, what does that look like? I mean, how do we get to a place where there is, where the kind of hatred and the divisiveness is taken out of society? What sort of institutions are emerging in a country or globally that get to that place?
I mean, that's something we've been looking at since the dawn of time, right?
I know.
And Plato's Republic was an attempt. And I think we are kind of as humanity always pushing towards that. We're always trying to create better communities for ourselves and for the generations to come. And I think there's something really human and something really admirable about wanting to do that. You could say that like the current constitutions of Europe largely came out of the French Revolutions, right? In which there was an overthrow of the aristocracy, and we developed the French Constitution and built on that the Norwegian Constitution as well, which kind of has a parliamentary democracy at its core. And I think that was significant, but it's a couple of hundred years ago now, and the world has changed. People have found new ways of exploiting the system and exploiting each other. And so it's always time to look at those documents and those institutions that were created and say, hey, how can we do this even better? How can we fight corruption among politicians? How can we fight the fact that those who essentially want power are the only ones who seek it? Like all of these kind of fundamental questions of how we are ruled and how we are led as nations as well.
So do you think possibly we're moving into what some people describe, I've heard described as almost like a post-democratic age? It's almost like the, you know, talking about the French Revolution was some decades ago, and the systems we have created from that are no longer fit for the modern world. So actually what's required is some kind of new form of democracy, which, as you say, to your point, allows people to participate who are not necessarily the people who crave power.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting thing you said there.
And so I think, of course, those who seek power are those who crave power, which is a fundamental problem of how politics work, I guess, because quite often the people who have the knowledge or the people who are possibly best fit to see the world and analyze it and figure out what to do next might be doing something completely different with their lives, and a lot of them will be. And so, you know, that's kind of just one of the problems of how the system works. But at the same time, I think post-democracy is a dangerous path in some ways, because that seems to remove even more agency from individuals, right? But I think there's other things that have appeared since the French Revolution that are worth looking more at, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, right? Which essentially ensures the value of every single human being and their agency. And so I think with a basis in that, which kind of is aging but still younger than the constitutions, it's worth looking at how do we actually embody that as societies? How do we actually build societies that respects that builds on those values? Because we haven't really to such a great extent yet. And it all builds out of the same kind of philosophy of democracy, but democracy means more than just voting for representatives to some parliament or voting for a president or a prime minister. It means an actual kind of civic engagement, and it means that you have certain freedoms and certain duties, and you have the freedom to express opposition when the political powers are doing strange things. You have the duty to essentially push for progress, to push for better communities and societies. And so I think those values needs to go hand in hand as we push towards whatever is next. And that doesn't necessarily have to be representative democracy in the way we've seen in the past. Like, we also have, through the ever-evolving landscape of technology, etc., potentially power to create new ways of making decisions as communities and as societies. And then the question is kind of how will that function at different scales, from a local kind of community council to national councils? How do that transform those processes, which is really kind of a fascinating field as well.
Yeah, it is. There is a kind of, I believe in some senses, a bit of a contradiction, because it seems that in the world that some of the people who are trying to cause this disruption are saying that actually we are in an unhappy place. But actually, if you look back over recent times, there's been fewer wars over the past decades. You know, our health systems globally are much better. Many, many things have advanced, which means that we live longer. But actually, yeah, as a human race, actually, we're in a much better position than we've ever, ever been. And yet we seem to be, at the same time, more and more dissatisfied. And it seems to be a strange contradiction.
Well, I think it comes down a lot of that to how you measure. Like, what are you looking for when you are asking whether humanity is happy or not? And I think, yes, on one hand, we live longer, we have better health systems, we have fewer national wars. At the same time, we are seeing vast differences within nations, and we're seeing wars happening not between nations, but within them. There's a lot of civil unrest going on, and there's a lot of tension and conflict that doesn't necessarily manifest in war, but still that drives people apart from each other. And so it feels almost as like the world, if you look at it from kind of a globalist perspective, if you look at it from a perspective of nations, is coming closer together, but within those units that we often divide ourselves into and measure by, the divisions are growing, and the dissatisfaction is growing, and the ability to function as communities rather than as divided might be diminishing. And so I think those are some things that will need to be addressed as we kind of evolve. And I think there's several aspects to this, and one of them is, of course, that we are spending more time staring into a screen than speaking to our friends these days. And I think that's a problem, but not necessarily an insurmountable one. We have to remember that these technologies that enable us to communicate with people on the other side of the globe, but disable us to some extent from communicating to the people sitting next to us, are in their infancy as well. There are new technologies, there are new things that affect how we live our life and who we communicate with and how we communicate. And so all of that is something that will evolve, and something that we have to adapt to, and something that we will adapt to in different ways as well. And with that, our societies will adapt as well. So I think there's a more complex nuanced answer than just, yeah, things are going better, or yeah, things are going worse. We are complex people living in complex societies. And so there's a lot that can happen and a lot that will happen. And some of it will be good and some of it will not be good. But overall, I think humanity is always pushing for whatever is better.
Yeah, you have to be an optimist. We have to be optimists. But again, you're kind of putting one of the fundamentals that we are looking at here in this kind of what a potential newism might be, which often comes up a lot when people we speak to, is about community. And it's almost like people are saying national borders now are not relevant, saying, you know, I'm part of this country. Actually, we're global citizens on the one hand, which we have to have some kind of norms and values about, of like you might say, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, for example, all of us in the world. But actually, the nation state's no longer appropriate. It's about our community, use that word often. And it's those communities and how we define that and how we look after each other in these smaller communities connected with a bigger world, if you like. And then how does that community, you know, become self-sustaining? How does it support itself and the people in it, and how does it then connect to other communities? So those become fundamental parts, rather than I'm from Norway or Sweden or UK or wherever. Is that something you see as a possible solution to some of the divisive challenges we have going forward?
I think, yeah, to some extent, I think we can look for where does our senses of belonging lie. I think one of the, and what is the purpose of a nation and a state versus what is the purpose of a community? And I think like a lot of people are selecting to live in certain neighborhoods, they're selecting to live in within certain communities. I've chosen to live in Sweden, but I've chosen to live in this specific area of Sweden as well, where I have friends, where I have a community, where we care for each other as neighbors as well. And I think that that is one way of looking at that. But at the same time, we also have a lot of infrastructure right now. And I think, I've chosen to live in kind of this specific area, but at the same time, we have the infrastructure that is largely provided by Sweden and Norway to some extent here as well, because I'm right on the border. But like, I depend on internet access in order to be able to do my job, right? And even though the people I work with are far away in different countries, there's still those, I still need to be able to plug into the wall at the end of the day to be able to connect to those people. And so my economy personally is dependent on me as an individual essentially trading with the rest of the world and working with the rest of the world, which is something that used to be largely facilitated by nations, but is more happening on an individual basis now, I think. But at the same time, I still depend on there being a national power grid and there being fiber lines and all of those things that goes to infrastructure, and a lot of that is also privatized these days, but still organized through this concept of the state, right? And so those are significant factors of kind of how the relationship with the state still is there, even though we as individuals tend to possibly oversee it quite often. But at the same time, we have kind of the bigger questions of running things like healthcare, running things like the educational system, running essentially law enforcement, which laws should be enforced, and how do you decide on which laws should exist in the land, things like that, which is kind of still what's left to parliaments. And all of that is terribly important as well. It's just the processes to determine that might be changing. And so I think one of the things that we sort of largely lack an understanding of is how our countries function and how our processes of change function. I think one of the failures largely of kind of public education any form of education, but the education of the public rather than public education in terms of like school, private schools versus public schools, you know, what lacks in the education of the public is largely an understanding of how those processes function, but also how we might be able to change things. A lot of people seem to think of the founding documents, the founding institutions, the foundations of our countries are static, and reality is that we've built democracy as a model of change, not a model of maintaining a status quo. And so we need to learn about that and discuss that and see how can we use this system to create a better and new system, which it allows for, which is part of the kind of founding principles of democracies, right? So I think that's kind of a large question. But at the same time, there's also the questions of what values do we want behind these systems. Like we, as I mentioned, education of the public is an important element of that. But does that mean we should have a public education system? Does it mean we should have a private education system? Does people have an inherent right to education? I believe that people have a right to education and that there should be a good public education system. But not everyone agrees with me, obviously. And I believe that that should come from an understanding that we should have an equality of opportunity as people, regardless of what background we come from, where we come from, who our parents are. We should have an equality of opportunity to create the changes that we want and to lay the path for ourselves as individuals and as communities as well. And that doesn't happen without education, and it doesn't happen without healthcare and some of these kind of fundamental institutions that we have.
Yeah, I mean, these then, what you're talking about then, become fundamentals to any economic system that we wish to build them on. So, equality around opportunity and therefore an education system which is for all surely must make sense, because actually, unless you have that, then you're denying potential talent to emerge.
Right.
People don't get that, whether it's your community or your nation or the world, if you don't allow that talent to emerge, it's kind of stupid, is it not?
Yeah. Sure. It's a waste of resources, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. So that becomes one of the kind of fundamentals. I mean, one just changing subject slightly, one of the areas I just wanted to talk to you about was obviously the whole issue of peace and how you kind of move towards a society where we reconcile. Now, you survived the shooting in Norway nearly 8 years ago. A lot of people, having been part of that, would have been angry and taking sides and wanting retribution. But you haven't taken that line. You've moved towards trying to understand what motivated the shooter and how you understand it and reconcile it and move forward. And that's to me is fascinating, and is a part of what I would call advanced humanity. We move on, and how do you do that? Now, I'm fascinated by what motivated you to go down this route, and what motivates you around this following that incident for peace.
I mean, there's kind of moments in life when you can choose a path, and I think that was one after the terrorist attack in 2011. I think I had the option of going kind of down the drains and be angry and be angsty and be all of these things, but it's not terribly productive, and it doesn't bring us any further. And I mean, I was 20 at the time, and I didn't want my life to be lived in the shadows of a terrorist attack. I wanted it to be lived building something better, building something in which, building a world in which these attacks don't happen, in which the hatred leading up to those attacks doesn't have the grounds to fester. And so really that was kind of a simple choice in some ways, even if not a very conscious one at the time, that I wanted to build both a world and a life that wasn't driven by fear and hatred, but driven by aspirations for betterment, for building something better. And so, yeah, that was kind of pretty much the thinking behind that.
Total respect for you and admiration, but a lot of other people wouldn't react like that, would kind of say that, they wanted to kind of, cut the guy into little pieces and throw him in the sea and take up a stance in a different way. But you've actually been a leader in the talks you do, and talking about how actually to create a world where you don't have these type of people emerging, have to move on. And I think you've seen that in the more recent terrorist attack in New Zealand, where the Prime Minister there almost immediately took a completely different line of kind of refusing to mention the guy's name and talking about reconciliation, moving on. And it's almost like that message would accord with what you stand for. And I think people were fully admiring her and understanding where she was coming from.
Yeah, so I think there's admirable things about that way of moving on. But at the same time, I think one of the significant differences between me and Jessica Auden and her approach to that is, first of all, she has to lead the nation. I only have to lead myself. And secondly, in me leading myself, it's been terribly important for me to use Breivik's name as well, and speak the name of the terrorists in Norway, because you have to see them as human beings. You have to see them as members of our societies and our communities in order to be able to address the fact that they came out of our communities. And there's something deeply unsettling and something deeply problematic about our communities if they are producing people like this. And our communities are, like, in addition to the terrorist in 2011, Norway has produced a fairly large amount of racists and far-right extremists, but also a fairly large amount of Islamist extremists who have gone off to join terrorist movements abroad. And so I think both of those are highly problematic, and says something about the Norwegian society and Norwegian community and our failures, really, of caring for each other and seeing each other and figuring out how to deal with the problems that individuals in our societies might be having. And so in doing that, we need to speak about the people who represent the problem as well through these actions. And so you don't reconcile and you don't move on by pushing things under the carpet or by hiding it or by not wanting to speak about it. You speak about it, you address it, and you figure out how to create a path forwards. So I hope that makes some sort of sense, right?
No, completely. And it's fascinating what you say. That's why it's so interesting, because you're actually going, well, your line really is, this isn't just a kind of monster who's appeared out of nowhere. You're basically saying there were some issues with the way society structured that allows people like Breivik, now that you've mentioned his name, to emerge and then to do this dreadful deed, which he's obviously been planning for a long time.
Yeah.
And so therefore, how do we change the society so that these people aren't created? But it does mean that you've got to go towards that, these people, this evil, these darkness, if you like, to try and understand it. And that, for somebody such as yourself who've survived, must have been an incredibly challenging thing to do.
Yes, it was challenging and it still is challenging. I still think it's important to do, and I think it's so important to do that I've been doing it even though it's challenging, right? So I think, like, one example is on the 26th of July this year, so in 3 days' time from our recording of this podcast, there is the 8th anniversary of the terrorist attack, and I've put together a panel, a small panel in Oslo, in which I will be speaking, and a former neo-Nazi, someone who used to stand closely to Breivik in terms of his ideology, is coming to share the stage with me, as well as other experts in kind of this field of trying to build communities without that hatred and without that violence. And so, like, bringing those people together who come from such different backgrounds is important, but also speaking to people who have been there, people who have been like Breivik or been having had the experience of having that hatred within them. It's really important to understand in order to understand where it comes from and how we can help other people reform and other people come out of it again, but also how we can help prevent people from going down that route by building essentially communities in which we care for each other and in which we speak to each other and where diversity is accepted and celebrated. And the fact that we are different, all of us, regardless of whether we like it or not, is seen as a strength. It's something that makes our communities better because it gives us the power to see the world in different ways, where that is something that is kind of celebrated and seen as empowering rather than as a disadvantage as Breivik saw it as. And that's these people who live lives of hatred see the world as, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard, indeed, actually, met kind of from in UK, from Ireland, kind of former terrorists who have articulated in some ways that hatred and where it comes from, and that you know, just hated the people who lived 2-3 streets down the road. kind of thing. And it is about that dialogue. If they'll talk about how they've been able to change as a result of dialogue and understanding, even although quite interestingly they don't necessarily change their political position, say, but they but they change their outlook in terms of violence or hatred,
or just their view on different people. I think, like, I've met a bunch of people in the UK who's been through this as well, and across the world, really, the stories are largely the same. You hate people you don't know and don't interact with, even though they live three streets down. You don't really interact with them, and what you build in your mind is a story about who they are rather than an actuality of who they are, because you've never actually interacted with them. And so a lot of kind of the fear and hatred against different communities come out of ignorance and out of the fact that they've never spoken together than out of something more genuine than that.
So, I mean, absolute respect for the work that you're doing, and I think it's for lots of people who will be listening to this, will be saying, in terms of the thinking, in terms of the world going forward, we should be building it on, you know, diversity, understanding, dialogue, and moving away from some of the kind of division that seems to be emerging in the world, people taking up different positions. And that has to be the kind of basis, I think, on any new ism, the area that we're talking about, which is about inclusiveness, fairness, and therefore a kind of fundamental value has to be about us understanding one another and respecting one another so that we can live together. But I mean, I could talk for a long time with you, but we only have so much time, so we've got to finish now. But really appreciate your time and your insights, which, you know, have obviously been those insights you probably had anyway, but they've obviously been accentuated by what happened with Breivik on all those years ago, and I really appreciate you sharing those insights with us. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bjorn's vision and insights for a more harmonious and tolerant world are all the more extraordinary in light of his story, and we hope you feel as inspired as we do. Join us next time when we'll be talking to another great guest. And if you have a moment, please do rate and review us on iTunes so that more people can discover the extraordinary potential of social entrepreneurs to create a fairer economic system for the world.